Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 21st of May. Mondays at 9 o'clock, we do all things political, and we have a lot to talk about this hour with William Nykerk, who is chief Washington correspondent for the Chicago Tribune and senior correspondent for the Tribune as well. He's written about all kinds of topics. Last week, he was at the Rose Garden, and his piece, From One Embattled Leader to Another, A Fond Farewell. We'll talk about that, about what he says the language was in the Rose Garden, which never seemed as rosy as it sounded on Thursday when President Bush and Prime Minister Tony Blair appeared to be competing over how much they admired each other. They'll talk about we'll talk with Bill about the friendship that appeared to deepen as the war grew uglier. And there's some talk I heard over the weekend that Tony Blair may be the new president of the World Bank. We'll ask him what he thinks about that. Senator Barack Obama, according to the Des Moines Register, second in the Iowa poll right now. We will look at that. We'll look at gas prices, which he wrote about recently. I was in Chicago over the weekend where the unleaded regular was $3.60. Isn't that amazing? So we'll talk about that. And I don't know. It seems to me as though it's going to go up over the course of the summer. Immigration reform, of course. We'll talk about President Carter blasting the Bush administration and so much more. Feel free to join us. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Hello, William. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, hi, Kathleen.
Yeah, hi.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you. Let's talk about that meeting in the Rose Garden that you attended with Blair and Bush. I've never really fully understood why it is that Blair aligned himself so closely with a policy that was so controversial and that seemed to be failing and kind of did him in politically. Why did he stick with our president?
Good question. I wish I knew the answer to that because I've always been puzzled by that. I think it has a lot to do with the special relationship. And once he signed on to this policy, it was really, really hard to extricate himself from it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only explanation I have for it, because it did seem it was increasingly unpopular in Britain, increasingly unpopular in this country. Bush's polls are just in the dumps, and the same with Blair. Kelly, I don't know how to answer your question because I don't know British politics that well, but it did seem to be always been a bit of a surprise to me that he's hung on to it for so long. I guess it was just because he's Tony Blair and he believes he can, you know, solve all the world's problems, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think happens when he leaves office and Gordon Brown is scheduled to take power? Will the relationship change significantly or not?
There's great fear in Washington, at the Bush White House in particular, as to how that is going to change. Now, Brown has been issuing statements, of course, we're friendly with the United States, we're going to keep a special relationship going. But, you know, I think there's the sense of how much support is he really going to show for the war when we get down to the brass tacks.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a fear that maybe they'll start withdrawing troops sooner, won't rhetorically have as much support. And I mean, Tony Blair and George Bush are like, you know, two close friends, two old buddies at school who hung together all the time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the relationship will be cooler. It will be not as emotional as it was between Bush and Blair. And the Brits will assess it very coldly and differently, I think. But it's still, I mean, you raise a really good question. How are they going to extricate themselves from Iraq when there's a special relationship between these two countries?
Right.
Very interesting question.
Yeah. Well, let's ask you the question of how we are going to extricate ourselves from Iraq. What are you seeing happening in Washington in this regard? Are the Republicans going to jump ship come next fall? Are we going to see some kind of benchmarks, withdrawal, funding changes? What's up?
Here's the state of place I know it right now. Many of you probably who are listening probably heard Nancy Pelosi on George Stephanopoulos' show yesterday. It says, Bush has a 10-year, he just doesn't get it on Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
She's still talking about timelines to withdraw, you know, force withdrawal troops, and that's probably not going to cut it in Congress. I think that what was interesting about the Bush-Blair encounter in Rose Garden is that Bush sort of indicated he might support benchmarks of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
And these benchmarks would have to do with, you know, political reform, dividing up the oil revenue, being certain political objectives. There's a whole bunch of them which I couldn't possibly just spell off the top of my head. And that appears to be where Congress is probably going to wind up. They'll probably pass the funding for the war with some sort of benchmarks that the Bush administration thinks it's comfortable with, and that will get us past this year. But you raise a broader question about next year and where do we go from there. McCain is on the Republican side is the big supporter of the war, I guess, in the whole field, along with Duncan Hunter and, you know, some of the more minor candidates. And on the Democratic side, of course, you know where they all stand. They're generally, let's get out here as soon as we can,
right,
and whatever. It is really a complicated situation. And if McCain surges ahead, I think, and people buy into this, the McCain situation, I think that it will be an interesting election in the fall. It'll be an election over the war, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at it like that, it's always hard to predict because something could happen. Something could happen, either a terrorist attack or whatever, could change people's opinion. But the state of play as it is right now, it would be very difficult for McCain to win, I think, in a situation like that.
Yeah.
With the public attitude remaining the same. So I wouldn't push myself out there too far on a limb on this because I think it's just very, very volatile over the next 12 months.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've already had an election over the war, and the Republicans went down to a sound defeat. It seems to me as though somebody's got to come up with benchmarks, political reform, sharing of oil revenue, something, or the Republicans are going to be in huge trouble the next election cycle.
I think that's right. I think they see that in their own interest to do something. That's why Bush is sort of open to it. I just saw in the paper this morning a poll that basically said the public attitude has never been so pessimistic just about the direction of the country.
Hmm.
And much of this is tied to the war.
Mm-hmm.
I'm old enough to remember Vietnam and how people turned against Vietnam in the end. And and of course they treated the soldiers. We treated the soldiers horribly back then.
Yes.
There's a difference now, then and now in that. But it feels that same way,
mm-hmm,
that we don't think we can win this. We need to get out. And Kathleen, I said, to me, the test of leadership, in a way, is how do we get out in a way that is honorable, that we don't look like we just totally, completely lost this thing, that the Middle East doesn't blow up, it adds to terrorism, creates a new terrorist area.
Right.
All these questions, I don't hear a lot of these questions being talked about right now. It's mainly, you know, the voters spoke, we need to get out, we need to set the timelines.
Mm-hmm.
They need to do it, then it's over.
Mm-hmm.
One has to, in a way, hand it to Bush a little bit, I think, because he has stood firm on where he stands, and he says this is the front in the war on terrorism, and he's basically really hung tough on the war. And he is mentioning a side of this debate that Democrats do not want to talk about very much, which is, you know, what is the future of the Middle East? What is the future of terrorism?
Mm-hmm.
All these questions, and how we can get out honorably. So one has to. I saw one of the news magazines recently did a big piece on Harry Truman and why don't we have a Harry Truman now?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you can't say Bush is a Harry Truman because he really got us into this mess in the first place. But on the other one, he's the one person who's hanging tough in it, so he does have some Truman-esque qualities in that sense.
Yeah. What did you think of President Carter's comments saying that the Bush administration is the worst in history in terms of foreign policy?
Does he mean other than his own presidency being in the worst in history? I wouldn't go that so far. I don't think Jimmy Carter had the worst presidency in history, but he was not one of the shining lights as a president. And Bush administration fired right back and said he's irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
It's sad. Obviously, we disagree with that. It's a spectacle. It's an incredible spectacle to see a former president of the United States going after another president's policy that vehemently. I mean, this is not. He's the worst president in history. The worst administration in history. That includes James Buchanan, for God's sake. and that's going some. And I. And, Carter has, of course, has been one of our beloved ex-presidents, and people said he had a better ex-presidency than he did a presidency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that thing is wonderful. But on the other hand, he's written this book in which it tends to look at the Palestinian side of the debate in the Middle East. And that's probably a worthy kind of thing to write for the public to understand what's going on. But the fact that he appears to a lot of people to be siding with the Palestinians has made him a much more controversial ex-president than he
sure has been
7 or 8 months ago.
Yeah, extremely controversial. Back to Blair for just a moment. I don't know where I heard this over the weekend, some talk that he may become the president of the World Bank. Are you hearing that?
That was a rumor that was being floated around last week, and I even put it in one of my stories. It was just floated as a rumor.
That's mostly where I read it, in one of your stories then.
but it wasn't just in mine. A lot of people have picked up on that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that here's why I don't think it'll happen, because we, the United States, are asserting sort of this traditional arrangement we worked at the end of World War II to nominate the head of the World Bank, whereas the Europeans, under that arrangement, would name the head of the International Monetary Fund. The World Bank is this big, basically this big anti-poverty agency. The World Bank is the International Monetary Fund is an institution that deals with balance of payments, and when countries get into difficulty on the balance of payments, they can borrow from the IMF, and it's more of an economic kind of thing as opposed to a poverty thing. And so that deal has been working for, you know, since the end of World War II. Blair would be a very, very interesting head of the World Bank if it were to go that way,
mm-hmm.
because the World Bank is in terrible, terrible shape right now after Wolfowitz went over there. But it was in terrible shape before Wolfowitz went over there, because it's losing a lot of its relevance. A lot of these countries, which are former, you know, poor countries, have come of age or middle-income countries. And they can tap the private markets for loans. They don't need World Bank's loans necessarily. And so the bank is going through its own kind of paroxysm, if you want to call it that, its own internal simmering debate over how to reform itself to become, more relevant in this 21st century world.
Mm-hmm.
And Wolfowitz, because of that scandal by arranging a pay raise for his girlfriend, has sort of created a lot of unhappiness, and there's a lot of internal
mm-hmm.
debate at the bank. And one of the issues on this, if you permit me.
Sure.
You know, the World Bank is a huge bureaucracy. It has 7,000 or 8,000 employees, something like that. And it's sort of reminiscent of the UN. I mean, the UN, when Bush sent Bolton to the UN, and that was extremely controversial,
mm-hmm.
extremely dissenting, because he wanted to remake, you know, the UN. There was a lot of protest. Now, you can look at this from a political standpoint, but you can also say, well, maybe Wolfowitz did have some right instincts. Maybe the World Bank, maybe it didn't go about it in the right way, but the World Bank needs to wake up, and it needs to reform as well as the UN.
Mm-hmm. Before we go to phone calls, let's talk about gas prices for a moment. Our audience will bring us into immigration, I'm sure. You wrote a piece, a blog piece, some time ago, actually, on gas prices, May 9th, not that long ago, gas prices going up and really going up. I was in Chicago over the weekend, and it was $3.60 for unleaded regular. Isn't that amazing?
That must be a record. I don't think it's ever gotten that high.
Isn't that amazing? I was just dumbfounded. And then it just sort of takes you think, how far am I traveling? How much is it costing me to do all of this?
Right.
People are going to be hit hard by this, and they're probably going up, aren't they?
Yeah. Some people used to – a friend of mine put the – what do you call the – with the coffee test, Starbucks coffee test.
Oh.
Which is that if you pay more for gas than you pay for double skim latte grande, then it's high.
Huh.
So, I mean, but I think the point that this person was making is, what's the big deal? You know, people can afford to pay these high prices. You know, they go out and buy very expensive coffee. What's the big deal? You go fill it up. But I think now, this summer in particular,
mm-hmm.
people are really feeling the pinch like I've never seen before.
Yeah.
at $3.50, $3.60, pushing toward $4. And for no apparent economic reason other than the fact that mainly the refineries are not producing, or did not produce early on in the season as much as they did before because they had a number of outages, and it's going to be hard for them to catch up with the demand. Now, I'm sure a lot of your listeners are going to say, and maybe rightly so, they're just, you know, ripping us off. Mm-hmm. They're just ripping us off. They're gouging us. You know, why didn't they invest all that money when they had the chance to do it, to build more refinery, and to build more expand the refineries and get more capacity out there? And that's not the only reason why gas prices are going up, but the gasoline price is not in the same correlation with the oil price was as it was last summer. The oil prices are actually lower than the peak of last summer.
Mm-hmm.
So this has to do with gasoline demand, which is up around the world in the U.S., and also the product hasn't kept up with the demand.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Bill. William Nykirk is our guest, chief Washington correspondent and senior correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. All things political this hour. We always do this on Monday morning. Obviously, we have more to discuss. Immigration reform very much being discussed today in the Senate. And the war we can talk about. We have to talk about Senator Barack Obama's coming in second place behind John Edwards in a poll in Iowa. Does it mean anything or not? And wherever you want to take us, do it. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee this morning, then you can call 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Rhonda Fanning is answering phone calls today, so she'll chat with you for a moment and get you on hold, and we'll be with you momentarily. Lines are open. Almost all the lines are open now, so grab one. We'll be with you in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, Nancy Pearl has her new book. We've been talking about this for some time with Nancy. It is Book Crush. And it's recommendations for every mood, moment, and interest for kids and teens, for children who have just been born all the way to young adults. And she arranges them by different categories. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful series of recommendations. She's just terrific. And it's a pretty regular guest with us. So Nancy will be joining us hour number two of our program. All things political this hour. Our number is 800-486-8655. The Tribune, Chicago Tribune, Washington correspondent and senior correspondent, Bill Nykirk, is our guest, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls momentarily. Let's just for a moment, because he's from your neck of the woods, talk about Barack Obama and the poll in Iowa showing that he's in second place behind John Edwards, who's been camping out in Iowa. What do you think? And then we've got Senator Hillary Clinton is third, and Bill Richardson is fourth. It's early, but does it make a difference?
Well, yeah, I think it does make a little bit of difference. I mean, this is the first poll I've seen that we're able to surge ahead, even with the caucus as opposed to primary. It's so early for me. I'm not the chief political writer in the Bureau, so I can't really go down to the details exactly. But it's just interesting that Edwards, of all people, should be pushing ahead. I think it's going to be very good for him if he can pull off a victory in Iowa, which was originally one of the really early states. But what's interesting about the new primary schedule next year is everybody's pushing to be early. I mean, it may be Christmas or earlier when we have these earlier primaries. I'm going to wonder how much will Iowa mean in the great big picture when push comes to shove. Even Illinois, I think, is moving back to February the 5th. And other states are trying to get moving back earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So the question I would have there is, you know, how widespread is this? Because in all the other polls, Hillary Clinton has been ahead of Obama. Obama's in second, and Edwards has just run third. Now, it was interesting to me in a Larry King interview about a month or so ago with Bill Clinton, and King was questioning Bill Clinton about, you know, are you scared of Obama, da, 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 da. And he said, I'm surprised that Edwards is not doing as well as I expected him to be. And I thought that was an odd comment because Did this really mean that he actually feared John Edwards, as a potential rival to Hillary? There has always been the sense that at some point that Obama might flame out, but he hasn't so far.
Mm-hmm.
He hasn't so far, but Edwards has a few liabilities of his own, I think. He doesn't seem as fresh a figure as Obama is. Hillary has got a tremendous amount of money and is, seems to be the favorite of more Democrats. He ran as vice president once before and doesn't seem to have the same political base that these two people have.
Mm-hmm.
That's just my quick top-of-the-head analysis.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to phone calls for you. 800-486-8655. We start with Tim from Mount Zion. Hi, Tim.
Hey, good morning.
Hi.
I was real taken by gentleman's comments about President Carter, and I think as far as foreign policy goes, I think one of the key things is our dependence upon foreign oil. And maybe I need to remind gentlemen about the tax credits for alternative energy that were available in the Carter administration and the immediate withdrawal of those and then the taking down of the solar panels from the White House by President Reagan. And so here we are, a lot later. We could have been so much further ahead and so much less dependent upon foreign oil. And, we better get going here.
Hmm. What about the current Congress? Are they going to fashion some kind of comprehensive energy policy? Do you think we need an energy policy, William?
Oh, yeah, we definitely, Jim was right, we need an energy policy,
mm-hmm.
policy for sure. And there already is legislation to, increase the subsidies for ethanol. And by the way, on ethanol, some people are complaining now because corn prices are going up.
Yeah.
And farmers are saying, maybe we don't need subsidies for ethanol. But I think you're going to see even more tax incentives, tax preferences to develop more renewable fuels and alternative energy as time goes on. There's a lot of stuff in the law already. I mean, there's wind power. They get production credits. I mean, one of the key elements here is the price of gasoline and the price of oil. If it is higher in the market, and it is, it's there now, a lot of these technologies themselves will become, doable.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we don't need all these subsidies. But back to the gentleman's comment on Jimmy Carter administration. I actually covered the Carter. I'm old enough to have covered the Carter administration, so I remember very well. You're right. Jimmy Carter had some big projects. There was a synfuels thing that he set aside, synthetic fuels, whole new plant. It never got anywhere, and it was a big scandal. Another thing he tried to do is use price controls to control the price of gasoline. And we had these huge, long gasoline lines in America, which angered everyone. And it was largely traced to the fact we had these controls and moving the gasoline from one part of the country to another, which is really hard to do. A government can't do these things very well. And a lot of people blame the gasoline lines on Jimmy Carter for that reason. So he did some good things, and some other things he did not so good. So that's what I'd say about Jimmy Carter on energy.
Thanks very much for the call. We go next to Linda from Madison. Hi, Linda.
Hello. Interesting show. And I had to call with a cliche question. We have good friends in Europe, and it's always interesting to hear their perspective. But I'd love to hear what your guest has to say about two topics. One is why do Americans think they are absolutely entitled to low-cost gasoline? I listen in amazement as people call the talk shows and say with a lot of rage, it's my right to drive an SUV. I can't possibly survive in a small car, even though people have the smallest families in the history of the country right now. It's not as if you're transporting the soccer team every day, as the ads seem to
exactly,
imply that you
yeah.
are. But our friends in America think, of course, we've lost our collective minds for several reasons here. And my impression is if gas was twice as much, Americans really wouldn't change their habits. As your guest said, these are the same people buying double lattes for $5 and $6 a clip, all these frivolous, silly electronic gadgets that nobody needs to live a good life. So my first question was, where does this idea come from that we're absolutely entitled to cheap gas, and if we can't get it from other people, we're being ripped off and used in some way? And my other question simply was, I'd love to hear what he has to say about our perception of the amount of space we need in a vehicle. Apparently, we need to drive a living room on wheels everywhere we go. And people tell me with great sincerity that the only way they can be safe is to drive these tanks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, I bought a small car when my American-made car truck died. Didn't take too long, unfortunately, but I thought, I'm just not going to pay these prices anymore. I can't afford it. And I bought a very small car, and I've been very happy with that. But you're almost backed into continuing on with large vehicles because you feel like you're going to be rear-ended at any moment. So in that way, it's an unfortunately self-perpetuating situation.
William.
Well, I chuckled a little bit then, but actually it's not a funny situation because Detroit can get extra money for making these big cars. There was nothing to prevent them. Gasoline was, from an inflation-based standpoint, has not been that expensive in the United States as it has been in Europe. You're absolutely right. It's still, you know, twice as much to run a vehicle in Europe and have smaller cars. Part of it is Detroit wanting to profit. Part of it is the other, you know, it's America. I think you put your finger on something. This is harder for journalists to say. But it's a sense of entitlement. It's a sense that we've always paid relatively lower prices in this country. And, you know, at $2 a gallon, a lot of people say gasoline prices, that's high.
Yeah.
But really, inflation, if you look at this in inflation terms, it's not. It's relatively cheap gasoline, you know. When you go back to, I remember paying 29 cents a gallon when I was a very, very young person.
Oh, my.
And no more. But the idea of having so much space in our cars so that the house, it begs another question. You know, if gasoline goes to $4 a gallon, it could. I mean, you know, you have another Katrina or whatever, it could. You still have to drive. You still have to, you know, transport people in these very huge cars, and you're going to be using a lot of gasoline, creating more demand.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you get these things off the road? I mean, you know, they're going to be around for a while.
Yeah.
People are not going to sell these things right away. I mean, they've got pretty good investments in them. I know an economist who has a plan which would never get anywhere in this Congress. But he would say, let's pass a huge gasoline tax and use some of the proceeds to buy some of these old cars up,
mm-hmm.
big SUVs, and get them off the road so mm-hmm. we can get a, you know, so that people can invest in some of the hybrids and get better mileage. I think this is one of the big questions of our time. And I don't think it's as easy to come to an answer and come to a conclusion about this simply because it's profits and it's people's habits.
You would think, though, William, that a lot of people who have these SUVs and these big cars, I for the first time paid $30 to fill up a couple weeks ago, and that struck me, and I have a small car. Whoa, $30. And then you
sticker
think,
shock.
Pardon?
Sticker shock.
Yeah. And then you think about people who are driving big vans who are probably paying close to $300 a month in gasoline.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe some people can afford that, but that's a huge amount of money for gasoline. You would think that eventually people would think about changing their ways and changing their cars and lowering that.
I do think that you put your finger on the real issue here, which is the only way to get real conservation is hit people with a high price.
Right.
And
right.
they have to get above that Starbucks price.
Yeah.
When it starts to pinch, when you start to feel it, that's when you start to get conservation. But my point was on these things still being on the road, it's going to come slower because you have this huge, army of SUVs out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you sure do. We're talking this hour with William Nykerk. He is chief Washington correspondent for the Chicago Tribune, senior correspondent for the Trib, and it's all things political this hour. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Joining us in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050. A couple lines are open right now. Linda, thanks very much for the call. Let's talk about immigration reform for just a moment. The longer the bipartisan agreement is out there, the more people are picking at it. It seems to me as though they're going to have a hard time adhering to this bipartisan agreement. What do you think will be happening in the Senate today, Bill?
Well, they'll talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll talk about it some more, and they'll keep talking about it for the next couple of weeks. I think that there was that McCain had this instinct that he wanted to get this thing passed pretty quickly out of the Senate, but I think that that's probably not going to happen. They could try to force a cloture motion, but this is like 300 pages. It's one of the more complicated bills.
Oh, my.
It's like 300 pages to come out of Congress, and it affects millions of people.
Mm-hmm.
Millions of people. And to dash this thing through quickly, I just don't think it's going to happen. And I think, you know, from out yonder Wisconsin and Chicago and so on, you know, voters are starting to take a look at this and say, holy mackerel, this is, just think of the changes. We're going to have temporary guest workers in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the biggest question of all is this one of, is this amnesty or not?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it may not be amnesty, but it's approaching amnesty.
Mm-hmm.
And it has. So I think it's going to take a while for them to get the vote of this, and I think the longer they look at it, I just have my doubts whether this is going to pass. I guess I'll put it like that.
Well, then you have these big groups, employers now saying, listen, we're going to have a huge labor shortage if you put us through all this, you know, need to have certain job skills to get here. You're going to lose a whole labor force that does probably low-skill jobs, but there are huge numbers of people doing that in this country.
Right, and they're counting on the temporary guest workers, which don't have to meet these requirements to come through and do these jobs. But apparently there's still going to be the employers think there'll still be shortages.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're talking about is in the folks who are applying for the visas to get their green cards, whatever, and this new Z visa that they're going to have.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to be, if you're in this country already illegally, then you can start applying for these things. But for other people coming abroad, you know, to just this general immigration policy, they are setting these, you know, you've got to have this issue of education, job skills, math, science, technology, and that's what you're talking about. And I think a lot of employers really are concerned about that.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to phone calls. We go to Donna from Oshkosh. Hi, Donna.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to talk about something that is far more important, I think, than the oil or the immigration or anything, and that is the loss of 60% of our honeybees throughout the world. To me, this is much more important than 9/11, as horrible as that was. And my questions are, why has it taken so long for the public to be aware? 60% of the bees are lost, and it appears that they are lost either because of pesticides or, even worse, the towers that are transmitting
cell phones. Yeah.
Cell phones.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the event that that's the truth, and how long will it take us to find out the truth? You know, how many committees will we have to go through and how many investigations? Will those towers ever come down?
All right. William, is Congress taking this issue up?
Congress has had hearings on this issue.
Did they?
Yes. I know they had hearings because and the last hearing I saw on these, and I haven't really checked it lately, was that we don't know what the cause of this is.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a pesticide. It could be some sort of disease. People didn't seem to know. But the cell phone theory I hadn't heard, actually. And if it's something like that, all I can say is, holy mackerel, I don't know how you solve that problem. I mean, and it really becomes a test between the way we lead our lives technologically every day and the disappearance, if it is that, I don't know that it is, and the disappearance of an insect, of something that's very vital to our ecology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do we deal with that? That's what it is.
Well, who would be in charge?
That's a good question. Who's in charge of this, Bill?
Well, who would be in charge? Well, I mean, it would take an enormous enormous effort to try to tear down all the towers around the country, and how would we communicate with each other? The way we're going to communicate?
Mm.
I have not seen a firm conclusion that's what it is. So Stay tuned on that one. That's all I can tell you.
We need to do a show on that if we have time sometime this week. Probably other programs have done this, but we haven't done this. So we'll do a show on it this week, Donna.
I'm not as up to speed on the very latest stuff on this.
I don't think anybody is, though. That's the problem, Bill.
Yes, that is the problem. Yeah. That is the problem. Einstein is quoted as saying, without bees, in 4 years, civilization will be dead.
Wow.
So that's really, really, that should be the thing we're talking about more than anything else.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about it this week, and thank you very much for the call.
Thanks.
Our number is 800-486-8655, All Things Political this hour, and our guest is William Nykerk, Chief Washington Correspondent and Senior Correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. We're talking about a number of issues. Somebody bring us into the political race, too. We've got a lot of calls on... Well, maybe it's because the gas prices are so high. We have a lot of calls on cars and energy policy, but bring us into politics, too, somebody. Would you please? Our number, 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Nancy Pearl joins us next hour. She has a new book out now, and it is Book Crush for Kids and Teens, recommended reading for every mood, moment, and interest. It's 1,000 recommendations, and they're organized into 118 lists aimed at youngest, middle grade, and teen readers. Nancy, of course, the author of Book Lust and More Book Lust. You hear her regularly on NPR's Morning Edition, and she joins us quite frequently as well. As a matter of fact, we did a book club with her some time ago here in our studios. It was great fun. She remembers every book she's ever read. If you call in and ask for a recommendation for a 10-year-old who really loves dogs, and I hope somebody will call in with that, I'll read that book, she'll have it right there, top of her head. Nancy's with us the second hour of our show today. Bill Nykerk is here now. He is the Chief Washington Correspondent for the Chicago Tribune and the Senior Correspondent. And let's go next to Frank from Madison. Hi, Frank. Oh, did I press the wrong button here? Frank, are you there? Oopsie. Sorry. Call back, Frank. I don't know what happened to you. John is next from Green Bay. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm just calling to see if there's any information on... first of all, I drive an SUV. I drive an 07 Chevrolet Suburban, which is manufactured in Janesville, Wisconsin, by union people. And I don't drive it because I'm a union man. I'm not. But I'm wondering if there was ever any studies done on people that are driving whatever kind of vehicles, small cars, big cars, what they're getting actual mileage. People that are driving older cars maybe that are not maintaining them, not keeping air on the tires, not tuning them up. Where is the real, the real gas usage here? Is it really from new SUVs or newer SUVs that are maintained or not, or the people that are doing jackrabbit starts, braking to the next stoplight, and really, not really doing what the vehicle's intended to do.
What's your gas mileage, John?
The gas mileage on my truck, the sticker shows a city mileage of between 12 and 18, and a highway mileage between 17 and 23, and it is a 07 flex fuel vehicle,
mm-hmm.
Chevrolet Suburban.
Mm-hmm.
Which means you can get the better E85 ethanol in it, right?
Yes, yes. At which the mileage does suffer, with using that. I've checked it. Get about 25% less mileage. With the E85, if I run on a consistent basis.
Wow. You're asking for an answer to your question. I don't think there is any information. I don't think anybody does any studies on this at all, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm. I'm not aware of them either.
And it is a problem because it truly is, because there's a lot of things that people can do to get higher gasoline mileage. And you can see that the energy department is always putting out information. This is what you can do. But I don't think anybody really says this is what people are doing.
Yes, yes, yes. And I'm just wondering, that's a big concern. I see, I'm in Green Bay, Wisconsin. I'm not in Milwaukee. And I just see the people driving cars that, you can see the right rear tire is low. you know, it's spewing oil fume, or you know, you can just tell that the car is maybe running on three cylinders instead of four, where they think that they're driving a compact car, or we think that they're driving these little cars, is that they're more fuel efficient, and when in essence, I don't think that, you know, that they are. It's, you know, I have this investment of this newer vehicle, and it's done, the maintenance is done meticulously to at least get the mileage that is claimed on the window sticker. So,
but the thing is, Jen, your mileage is terrible.
It is terrible. Maybe you could say it's terrible compared to a Toyota, a brand new Toyota, or a brand new, even a brand new Chevrolet Compact or a brand new Ford Compact. But when you compare it to other vehicles that are out there driving around that are supposedly smaller and getting that.
Yeah, I got your point. Yeah. And it is true. I'm trying to remember what this is in my head somewhere, and I can't remember it, William, but California has done some of a kind of study that looked at the CO2 emissions and how many were generated by older cars in California, and it was a huge percentage. But obviously it's an issue that, I mean, what are you going to do about? A lot of people can't afford new cars, too. It's a thorny issue. It's a very complicated issue, we drive.
It would involve a different kind of, you know, system of rights in this country. Do you have a right to pollute the atmosphere?
Right.
Like that. Do you have a right to use up that much fossil fuel?
Right.
And how do you get at that? I mean, this is not, I don't think this is easy public policy.
Yeah. Thanks, John, very much for your call. Let's go to Frank from Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hello.
Hi, Frank.
How are you doing?
Okay. Lovely day it is in Milwaukee.
In Milwaukee. Well, Madison's great.
Good.
I have a question for your guest as a member of the press. Are the media, the press, and Congress really willing to look behind the events of the Gonzales card visit to the sickbed of Ashcroft?
Mm.
What was so illegal and so improper that even those right-wing attorneys in the Department of Justice were not going to reauthorize it? And, you know, I wonder if Gonzales was carrying the pillow, and that was one reason for the urgency to get there on the part of Comley. But
carrying the what?
The pillow.
The pillow,
it's a joke, sir.
That's a joke, okay. Okay.
And one of the things that is known is that not only were Americans spied on, but their ability to communicate was interfered with in 2003. And that doesn't seem to surface in the discussion of what the government was doing after 9/11. So thank you.
Thanks, Frank, for the call. William.
Frank, this is what I know about this. I mean, and what I read about it had to do with the, spying on people without a warrant, and that whole issue about going to courts or not. And this is what that was all about. And Gonzales and Andy Carter, who was the chief of staff at the time, went to Ashcroft's room to try to get him to sign off on the warrantless searches. And that's essentially what it was all about. And you, of course, read the dramatic confrontation there with Mr. Comey, who was the acting attorney general at the time. What a story. It was a great story. I think it was as simple as that.
Hmm. Our number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. Do you want to give any speculation here? Or obviously you're informed on this. Do you think that Gonzales is going to be around for a while, Bill?
Every time I say that Gonzales is going to be gone because of a new disclosure, I find that my previous political judgment is really, you know, gone. Snap. Just, you know, I've been thought for some weeks now he was going to be gone. Now, what was interesting is that Senator Specter said on one of the TV shows yesterday that there's a vote of no confidence that is due to come up in the Senate. If that passes, that will probably mean that he will finally, you know, give up the ghost. I don't know. I've seen him stand up to everything.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't predict that he would necessarily go. Specter might say that, but he doesn't appear to want to leave. And I don't think Bush really wants to push him out.
Mm-hmm. He's very big on this loyalty factor, isn't it? I mean, going back to what we were talking about earlier, Tony Blair seems to be big on loyalty as well. But this president really values people who have stood by him, been with him, helped him for years.
I think that's a more really kind of a fascinating story. He was that way with Rumsfeld for the longest period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had some people speculate to me that, you know, if he fired somebody, got rid of somebody just because somebody was putting the pressure on, this is like admitting defeat himself. This, you know, one of my own guys. I'm going to stand behind him to the very end. There's also the fact that ethnic politics may play something of a role. He is a Hispanic, very prominent Hispanic, and he has a top law enforcement job in the country. That may have something to do with it as well. But I think it really goes back to Bush and his backing.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to David from Fenimore next. Hi, David.
Hi. Good morning. I need to turn the radio down. Excuse me.
All right, David. I never know. All right, there he is.
I was a little bit surprised with your guess, kind of casual dismissal of the caller just before your last caller of the fact that there might be more to this than Comey's testimony. There have been people who are looking at this pretty closely. One, for example, I'd just like to mention Jonathan Tolley from teaches law at Georgetown University has several times claimed that this is an impeachable offense. The program that we know about, okay? But that Gonzalez's testimony, if you look at it very carefully, was talking about a program. The program being asked of him, okay, which suggests that there may even be other programs. And I think it really gets even further at the lack of integrity of this administration, and that there needs to be more intensive examination of what's happening here as it relates to abiding by the Constitution, following the law. Why is it that we are willing to accept from this administration that the reason behind a domestic spying was for our protection? I don't buy that for a minute.
Bill.
Yeah, I'm not aware of any other programs except for the warrantless searches that's involved in this. It could be, the caller may be right, there may be something else. This is not my area of reporting, but I'm sure you that reporters in this town are all over this story trying to find out as much as they can about it. And when they get something, it will you can be assured it will get thrown out there as quickly as possible. But I always thought it was mainly that, it was a couple of years ago, it was about the having a search potential terrorists without obtaining a court warrant.
Mm-hmm. Did you cover the Clinton presidency as well?
I did.
Because he's all over the place the last couple of weeks. Is he going to help his wife's campaign, what his role would be in administration? Can you talk a little bit about that, Bill?
Very interesting, because there are some people who say, well, you know, we had a Clinton presidency once,
mm-hmm.
and we want to have another one. I that's kind of a hidden factor in that campaign. You know, we're getting two for one, and do we really want Bill in there again? There's that factor. Then there's the other factor just about, you know, this looks like a Clinton dynasty here. And we're going to get, you know, people are going to recall what it was like during the Bill Clinton presidency. He is a huge campaign advisor, big fundraiser. She's a very bright, intelligent person, qualities, presidential qualities, no doubt about that. I'm just talking about people's perceptions, I think, and I think that while he's popular and it's going to help her to some extent, there are some people who will be turned off by this.
Mm-hmm. So we won't tell anybody, but who do you think our next president will be?
I've been thinking about that you will tell somebody who's a prediction. if someone just pushed a gun to my head right now and said, you know, pick one, I would say at this moment Hillary Clinton.
Really?
But I can see where, you know, that is a big hurdle to go by. But I can see I can see somehow a Republican pulling this out just because of the blue state, red state divide, and either John McCain or Giuliani. I still can't, for the life of me, I can't see Giuliani being the president. I can't tell you why exactly, but somehow the New Yorker having this campaign in the South, I just can't see that at the moment. And I think Mitt Romney has a big problem with the Mormon issue. Well, he seems to be getting over it a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, as time goes on. If you push me right up against the wall, I think that's what I'd say.
All right. And you said it. Thanks, Bill, so much for being with us. I enjoyed the hour.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Bill Nykirk, Chief Washington Correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. He is also the Senior Correspondent for the Chicago Tribune, joining us this Monday at 9, all things political. We always do this hour, and I look forward to it every week so we can cover all that's going on in Washington. And we covered a lot this hour. Thanks for all of your calls. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Rhonda for doing on-air production here as well. Thank you, Rhonda. Thanks for your calls. Copy of the show, call the radio store, 800-747-7444. The program number is 521D. We have news, and we'll return on the Ideas Network.